But I almost feel like if one person read a book about time management and one person read a book about like writing tips, and then they both tried to write a novel, I almost think the time management person would be like better off.
Hello and welcome to In Writing with me, Hattie Crissell. I think it's about 4 months since I last recorded one of these. I had recorded 2 episodes of a second series when the whole coronavirus pandemic kicked off and we then went into lockdown. So initially I thought, oh, I'll just wait and at some point it'll be appropriate again for me to go to other people's houses and record in their studies. But that's sort of seeming increasingly like a distant dream. So I thought I'll just go ahead and start recording them remotely and start releasing them and not get too bogged down in everything being perfect. So today's episode was the first one that I recorded remotely, and it's with the quite legendary author Curtis Sittenfeld, best-selling writer of novels including Prep, American Wife and Eligible. And Curtis is marking the publication of her 6th novel, Rodham, which sort of poses the question, what would have happened if Hillary and Bill Clinton had met each other and fallen in love, but ultimately decided not to get married and gone their separate ways? How would that have turned out for Hillary? It's a wonderful read. It's published in ebook and audiobook on Tuesday, the 19th of May. Or you can pre-order the hardback, which is out on the 9th of July. So I highly recommend that you do that. I read it in lockdown and found it just very, very gripping and beautifully written, as are all of Curtis's books. A quick note about how I recorded this and the sound quality, which is not ideal, I would say. So for acoustic reasons, I built a sort of fort in my living room. It was a very professional setup. You may have seen it on Instagram if you follow me. There were duvets involved, cushions, an armchair, a sort of clothes drying rack. It was very, very hot and sweaty under there, and it worked reasonably well. But the problem was that my laptop started to overheat the longer the interview went on, so it was making quite a lot of noise. And I've done my best to mitigate this in the editing, but if the sound quality is not perfect, I can only apologise. It's very irritating not to be able to do this under ideal circumstances, but never mind. Curtis was brilliant. She didn't complain that my friend tried to FaceTime me twice through my computer while we were talking. She didn't complain when we got cut off and we had to dial back in. She was brilliant, and she's a really warm, funny and smart woman. She was so interesting on the structure of a novel and how important that is, the power of a well-placed sex scene, and how to set yourself up to succeed at writing. So over to Curtis.
I actually was commissioned. I had been commissioned a long time ago to write a short story for you know, a place. And I did it. And it was an interesting experience. But, you know, this is just like in the last few weeks, because I sort of wasn't feeling it and wasn't feeling it. And I just thought, like, I just have to kind of crank it out. And then at the end, it did give me sort of pleasure and like transport me and make my brain feel really kind of occupied and in a good way instead of in a like frantic ruminating way. And so I kind of thought, you know, maybe I should try to write fiction. Even if it's almost like for the same reason I wrote fiction as like an 8-year-old or 10-year-old, like setting aside publication and payment and just like, you know, kind of do it as my own hobby.
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny you say that. I've been thinking about that a lot recently, because somebody pointed out to me that you know, I'm a journalist and she's a journalist, and she was saying as a kid she used to write for fun and as a sort of emotional outlet, and then now she just writes professionally and and she's kind of lost that other side of it. Does that reflect you as well?
Yes and no. I mean, I don't, like, I sometimes, you know, there's that expression that's like, do something you love and you'll never work a day in your life. And like,
yes.
I think that's kind of nonsense. Like there can be this element of, like you sort of, you know, monetize your hobby and then what? But if you said to me, you know, like, Curtis, would you rather be, I mean, I don't even know what, would you rather be like a hotel housekeeper, or would you rather be, you know, a lawyer, and then you write on the side? It's like, no, I would rather write as my job. And I feel incredibly, incredibly lucky. And it's certainly, there are moments where, you know, it's a grind, or, you know, I'm reading something I've written for like the 18th time. But I don't think there's any profession that's enjoyable all the time. And I think that for me, you know, writing novels is as enjoyable as it possibly could be for as much of the time as it possibly could be.
Yeah, that's good to hear. So normally when I make this podcast, I go to people's homes and we sit in their study and we talk about the room that they write in, which in your case would have been tricky anyway, because I'm in London and you're in Minnesota, is it?
Yes, Minneapolis, Minnesota.
Okay, but are you in the room where you usually do your writing?
I am.
Would you sort of paint a picture for me of what it looks like?
I will. So, it's funny, my family moved in August 2018 from St. Louis, Missouri to Minneapolis. So I have not lived in this house that long. And I was, you know, about halfway through writing Rodham. And there's a room where it's sort of like, I'm trying to think of how to describe this. So there's kind of like a kitchen that like segues without walls into a family room. And that's where my family spends a ton of time. Like, we have a TV there. You know, we read there. We sometimes play games there. And then behind, it's almost as if you would think that maybe like the house ends there. And then there's this little space behind that. And it's kind of like a long, narrow room, and it has a built-in desk and shelves, and it's clearly meant to be an office. But when we moved into this house, I think my husband, who's a professor, thought like, oh, this will be my home office where I'll sort of store books, but I'll primarily work at the university. And I thought, like, that's like this magic little space, you know, like it's not huge, but, and I almost had this idea, which I feel like I need to kind of remember that I had this idea, where I thought, like, it's small enough that I could only write fiction in it and not bring in any papers or books that don't have to do with fiction, and just let it be this very kind of small, pure space and be very focused. And in other times, I mean, I've had a room of my own in other houses where we've lived, but I always, you know, it's always like I'm writing fiction, and then like a foot and a half away, there's like tax forms. And so it all gets kind of, and I'll say, I don't, like, in this moment when I look around, it's not as if there's nothing in here that doesn't have to do with fiction. There's a lot of my kids' art, which is, you know, a nice thing, not a bad thing. But I think it might be time, like, there's papers on the floor. Like, I believe in like having a kind of clean space, but if you observe me, you would not know that I believed that.
So what's your sort of view as you sit at your desk? Are you looking at your kids' art? Or
so,
window.
I mean, I have a desktop computer. I actually got a new computer for the first time, I think, since 2008, which it was sort of a mixed blessing to be using such an old computer in the past, because I had a laptop and a desktop, but the desktop I used where I wrote fiction was so old that to access the internet was not worth the trouble, which was very good for like maintaining focus. And so sometimes I literally like I keep the laptop sort of outside the room. And if I have to go check something, I physically get up and walk out and check it. I now have a nicer desktop. And I mean, there are windows, so I can, but they're not, it's kind of a dark room. There's no window right next to my desk.
Right. It sounds lovely. It sounds like a little cozy sort of writing nest.
I think of it as almost, I mean, I know this has actually bad associations, but I think of it as like Harry Potter's little bedroom under the stairs.
So tell me a little bit more about how you use that room. What are your sort of writing habits?
So, I mean, usually, like my kids are, you know, grade school, they're 9 and 11. And I sort of work, you know, most of the hours when they're at school. Sometimes I go for walks. Sometimes I run air. I mean, in normal life, sometimes I run air. sometimes I, you know, have phone conversations with people. But so often when I sit down, I have a post-it note or a piece of paper, and I write down what time I start writing. I guess what day it is, what time I start writing, and like what page I start from. So let's say it's whether it's like page 2 or page, you know, 340. And it helps me, I think it helps me feel like I'm making progress, because it can be so incremental to write a book. And it's almost like holding myself accountable. And then I keep that. So then it's also a weird thing where like when I don't throw those pieces of paper away, even though they're, you know, essentially garbage, but it's like I might have like 10 pieces of paper that represent an entire novel at the end. And I feel sort of sentimentally attached then. But so I do that. And then I usually take off my cheap plastic Timex watch when I write. And you know, I have like some coffee or water, but I don't do anything like a candle or like anything mysterious.
So when you said that you make a note of which page you're starting on each day, is there a sort of number of pages that you expect to have written by the end of one session? I mean, what's your normal pace?
Well, it varies a lot. And I think in some ways that's almost like part of the point of kind of keeping that list, where it's sort of like, it's almost like I'm saying to myself, this is an ongoing process. Like some days are more productive than others. And it's not always like word count reflects productivity. Like it might be like, I wrote 100 words, but I had this really important insight into how to structure things. And I have a printer, and every day I print out what I've written. So, so I think that also, like, one, it's kind of like a backup method, but two, so I one time had a writing professor who would say, you know, if you start writing today, what you should do is look at the last sentence that you wrote yesterday or whenever, and then continue. Like, don't, you know, especially if you're writing a novel and you're on page 80, don't start today by like looking at page 1 and then, it's because you just have to move forward. And I mean, I strongly think, I think that different writers, obviously, as you know, have different methods, but I think almost like the easiest or most efficient way to finish a book is you finish the book, you let it be really messy, and then you go back and fix it, instead of, you know, you write one perfect sentence and then you move on and then you write another perfect sentence. Like I don't think I could finish a book that way.
Yeah, I mean, this does seem to be what everybody I've interviewed says. Everybody who's writing books says, just, you've got to keep going until you reach the end.
I know at least, I think I know two people who have the other method where it's like they do not move on until they have, until, you know, the previous sentence is perfect. And actually, it's interesting. One of them has written several books, and I think maybe one of them hasn't had a book published, but I don't know for sure.
When do you first remember writing, like for pleasure or
As
stories?
Soon as I knew how, yeah, from a very, very young, like, you know, 5 or 6. Yeah, definitely. Like I loved reading. I loved books and stories. And I did that thing that I think a lot of people do, which I remember, I'm not sure how old you are, but you know, the movie, the original Little Orphan Annie movie, is that on your radar?
It's on my radar. I haven't seen it, but okay. I do remember.
So I think I was born in 1975, and I think that it was in the theater in maybe 1980 or 1981. I went to see it with my family. I loved it. And I remember this because I wrote it and then left it on my dad's desk, not consciously, but like writing, like, I'm an orphan, you know, I live in an orphanage, and like very, being very sort of, you know, I don't know if plagiaristic is a word, but really borrowing very liberally and enthusiastically. And just, I think like so many writers, I loved reading, and I kind of wanted to, like, you know, I wanted to sort of have that experience that reading gave me, but was also kind of a creative act.
I know, I'm not sure that this will mean much to a UK audience, to be honest, but I read that you won this pretty prestigious prize. Is it the 17 Magazine Fiction Writing Prize?
Yes. So 17 Magazine, which I think might no longer exist as a print magazine, but you know, is maybe digital only at this point. So in 1992, when I was in high school in the summer, I won their annual fiction contest, and so it's a magazine for teenage girls, and it's, you know, like a lot of women's magazines, it's a mix of kind of you know, like sort of heavy hitting reported articles and like tips about how to apply mascara. And sure. I loved magazines from a very young age. I loved magazines, and I still do. Like, there's just something, like the sort of tactile experience of like holding it in my hands, and the shininess and the pictures, and like, you know, the long articles and the short articles. And, so anyway, they had an annual fiction contest, and the 17 had this, even though, I mean, again, as with so many, you know, parts of like women or girls culture, like it's easy to sort of make fun of a teen girl magazine. It also has this kind of illustrious history where I think Sylvia Plath had won the fiction contest at one point. I think maybe Laurie Moore had won the fiction contest. I sort of get confused over who'd won it and then who'd had fiction in 17, but it would publish people like Joyce Carol Oates. And so I won first place in the fiction contest, and I had a short story appear in there. And I guess that was maybe the first time I was paid for my writing, speaking of monetizing your hobby, which, you know, it's funny too, because now, you know, a person could be like 17 years old and have a huge YouTube following, but I think it was a little bit weirder then. And I have mixed feelings about, you know, kind of having public recognition early on, especially because it's like that story itself, you know, of course it's like, I would not put it in a story collection, like, I don't, it's something I wrote when I was 17 or whatever, and yet, you know, it's sort of out there.
Was that the point where you thought, I want to be a writer, I want to be a novelist, or at what point did it become something that you were pursuing seriously?
Well, it was sort of complicated, because when I was in high school, like, I had entered high school, you know, at the age of 14 as like a decent student. I was not an academic superstar, but I got pretty good grades. And I started struggling in a bunch of different subjects, like French and math and science. And so I had this very uneven kind of track record as I was applying for college, where I was, you know, the editor of the school literary magazine and wrote for the school paper and had gotten this national recognition from a magazine, and then had pretty bad grades in other subjects. And so it was almost like, I think I recognized that I had to play up my writing skills, because it was pretty much the only thing that I was good at. I enjoyed it, but it was also like, I just didn't have almost any other abilities that where I was like, you know, like any more than mediocre at best. I went to college. I ended up going to two colleges where I transferred after 2 years, and I wrote for the school newspapers, and I was more involved in the newspapers than the literary magazines, but I was a little bit involved in both. And I took, you know, creative writing classes whenever I could and felt very invested in those, and, you know, had really good experiences. And then I graduated from college in 1997, and I actually very intentionally looked for newspaper journalism jobs. I probably thought, like, I'll always write fiction, but it's probably a hobby or it's peripheral. It's not my main job. So I actually went to work the summer I graduated. I went and was not a permanent position, but I was an intern, like a paid intern, at a newspaper in the state of North Carolina. And it was a really interesting, challenging, eye-opening experience, where I was writing about, in this city that I was not familiar with, often about subjects I was not familiar with. So it might be like, sometimes it was like, this drugstore is closing, like this pharmacy is closing, you know, go ask people about it. And so it would be like me approaching people in the street and saying, like, you know, such and such drugstore is closing. How do you feel about that? And it was, that was such an uncomfortable experience for me. Like partly because I have a weird name. And so to almost say, my name is Curtis Sittenfeld, I'm with the Charlotte Observer, can I ask you about this pharmacy having closed? Which, of course, you know, the overwhelming likelihood was that the person, this stranger, had no feelings about the pharmacy closing. So at that point, I then applied for a bunch of magazine jobs, and actually went to work at a business magazine in Boston. And it was sort of a, it still exists, and it's called Fast Company, although it's now in New York. And it was kind of about, like, you know, the new economy and personal branding. And it was very, because I had been an English major, I had very little exposure to anything about corporate life or business. It was a real education for me. And I loved the editors I worked with, and it was one of those, like, it covered a lot of startups, and it sort of had the energy of a startup and this, you know, very like open, energetic office. And I think I felt like I was recognized there, where they would think, okay, you know, Curtis doesn't know about business, but she can write kind of like colorful, character driven articles. So I would write a profile of like a person who was a consultant to big companies and would like go into big companies and tell everyone, like, take your socks off and dance, or like weird things like that. And then this is a really long answer, but then I did that for a couple of years, and I then applied to get a graduate degree in creative writing. And that's when I kind of got on the track of, even then, I think I probably thought, oh, I'll be a professor, a creative writing professor, and write on the side. And you kind of can't count on your books selling enough that it can be a full-time job. But then I ended up being sort of, you know, stunningly lucky with my first book, and I did sell enough books that it became my full-time job. But even before I knew it would be my full-time job, it was going to graduate school that put writing fiction as opposed to journalism at the center of my life.
Yeah. And that was the Iowa Writers' Workshop. Right?
Yes.
And was it while you were there that you started writing prep?
Yes. So I still remember it was I entered the workshop like basically on my 24th birthday, and it was about 6 months later in January 2000 that I started writing what would become, chapters in prep in a writing class.
Yeah. I know that you're a very thorough plotter. I seem to remember you mentioning this last time I spoke to you. Would you talk me through a little bit your process as you start with a book in terms of planning out that plot?
So, well, I this might be, I don't know if this is like a good or bad thing, but I think often at the beginning of a book, I wildly underestimate how many pages it will be and how complicated the plot will be. And so I said to my editor, I thought Rodham would be 120 pages. Like it would be like almost a novella, and I think it's 416 pages. So it was very optimistic of me, but it's almost like I believe myself to be starting at the beginning, but sometimes it'll later turn out I started on page 70 and I just didn't know it. And a lot of times I just kind of start writing and write maybe, I don't know, like it depends if it's a novel or story, but maybe I write 10 or 20 pages and then I probably create my first outline. And I believe myself I don't think of it as my first outline, but like 10 outlines later, it turns out it was my first outline. And I sort of think, okay, this is the structure of the whole, and like this is the way the scenes work. And honestly, the strange thing about Rodham is I think it was not until I'd been writing for 2 years that I sort of recognized what the structure would be, and that is the structure of the book. Like there were times when I thought, okay, this is what it is, but I always revised it after that until 2 years in.
Yeah. Do you think of it as, I think it might be Stephen King who I read, I think it might be in his book on writing. I think he uses this metaphor where he says that when you're writing a novel, it's a little bit like archaeology in that you're kind of dusting away at something and it feels like it, by the time you have the novel. He said for him, it feels as though the novel was always there and he was just sort of digging it up and trying to figure out what the shape of it was as he went along. Is that how you feel about something like Rodham?
I think I feel both ways at different times where sometimes I do think of it like almost like an ice sculpture or something, which would imply that I'm creating it, or I'm kind of
Actively shaping it, yeah.
But or like the this is an even weirder simile, but I think of it like a like sort of a dinosaur skeleton in a natural history museum. And it's almost, I mean, this is, I really think in terms of structure and like the plot and the order of scenes and like what happens in each scene and what's shown and what's summarized. But like, so like, let's see, say that, you uncover all these dinosaur bones in a field somewhere. And then to me, the structure of the novel is how you assemble those bones is very important. But once you have, and that's the structure, the almost like the material you put over them doesn't matter that much, where it really is kind of the sequence of events, I think, like it matters much more than the mood or the sentence in any particular scene. And so like if you then covered the dinosaur bones with what looked like dinosaur skin, or if you covered the bones with like a sheet, a gigantic sheet, it would still actually retain a lot of the same shape. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yes, I do. I do. Is that because you think of it in terms of the reader experience of kind of building suspense and having surprising things happen at the right moments and that kind of Is that what's in your mind?
I think of it really in the specific moment. Like I don't think to myself, I need to create suspense here, or I need to make, you know, social commentary or political commentary. I think I just think of it as like, you know, like what would be the most interesting, like let's say this is the bit of information that emerges in this scene, or this is the one thing that really happens, you know, like it's like, you know, this woman realizes she forgot her keys somewhere, or like this person's toe is run over by someone's bike, or like whatever, like there's the thing that happens, and then there's like the most interesting way of depicting it, or, you know, having two characters interact or showing it. And I really think in terms of the specific things that are happening, and not like, I mean, I think instinctively there's a part of me that's like, oh, that was a really long but quiet scene, and so my next scene should be kind of more exciting and short. But that stuff is more instinctive, and it's almost like I don't even know that I'm thinking it. Yeah. And the stuff that I'm consciously thinking is like, what should happen next? What should happen next? Which you would think, based on this description, that I write like riveting murder mysteries.
Maybe that's you next. Do write riveting books. They're just not necessarily like thrillers.
I mean, that's in some way, like, it's like I feel like people will say, like, sometimes people almost say to me, like, I find your book to be like a page turner, and I don't know why. And I love, like, when people are like, I don't know why your book is as interesting to me as it is, I take that as like actually extremely high praise. Like, it's almost like somebody saying like your features aren't that great, yet you're beautiful, which, by the way, no one has ever said to me, your features aren't that great, but you're beautiful. But like, there is something where I don't know, like I like to feel like a little bit like I'm a magician, and the reader doesn't really know what's going on. And I also will say, the fact that I've, like, writing is the thing that I've spent tons and tons of time doing now for, I mean, 35 years. Like, if I'm 44, it's been more than 35 years. And so, like, I don't know, like, I do think that my instincts are, like, and I certainly know, like, not everyone likes my books, which is, I'm totally at peace with, but, like, I think there's so many kind of ways of being in the world, or, like, activities where I don't have very good instincts, but I feel like my fiction instincts are, like, very fully formed at this point.
Yeah. You've written two books, American Wife and Rodham, which have taken a real person as a sort of jumping off point for a fictional account, a fictional tale, a novel, if you will. I wondered how that differs from writing pure fiction. I mean, they're both fiction, so I'm not quite sure how to distinguish, but you know what I mean.
Yes, yes. So, well, the funny thing, I actually almost think of Rodham, American Wife, and also my book Eligible in the same category, which is a retelling of Pride and Prejudice, which is, I mean, if
loved
I were Laura Bush,
by the way.
Thank you. If I were Hillary Clinton, or if I were Laura Bush, I don't think I would see those three books as similar. But to me, because it's like, of course, you know, Hillary Clinton is a person, Laura Bush is a person, Pride and Prejudice is a book, but it's almost saying this plot, which is either the plot of another book or the plot of someone's life, which, again, you don't see your own life having a plot, but I might see your life having a plot. Yeah. The plot exists. And I think the thing about all those books that's consistent is, like, so the director of the Iowa Writers Workshop when I was there was a man named Frank Conroy, and he would say fiction is this conversation between the writer and the reader. And I think that something I like doing is having a conversation where you know something, or you have an opinion, or you have experience with this kind of like cultural or biographical phenomenon already, whether it's Pride and Prejudice or whether it's Hillary Clinton. And I'm saying, I know that you know something, and like, you know, I know, and I'm going to kind of play with your own expectations, and I'm going to maybe fulfill some of them and defy some of them. And like, we're having, like, it's almost like, you know, the difference between having a conversation about something, a topic you're already familiar with versus having a conversation about a topic you're not familiar with, where both of them can be very interesting, but they're sort of interesting in a different way. So I think that that's how I see it. And it is a little bit more, like, it's different to kind of overtly borrow facts or, you know, plot lines that didn't come from inside my head. But the interesting thing, like sometimes doing research, I'll come across tidbits, like, which might be about, you know, the life of Hillary Clinton, where it's just like, it's so interesting and it's so ripe for fiction. And just so, like, juicy and irresistible.
Yeah. How does an idea for a novel tend to sort of emerge for you? Or is it just different every time?
I think it's different every time. I mean, I think because I also like to write short stories, I think that a short story is more like an interesting moment, but it feels contained, or like a dynamic or something. And a novel just feels like a really big topic that I can approach in, you know, 17 different ways, or it feels like there's so much to say about this. I could be so interested in this for years at a time. So I feel like that it's not, there's not one thing where I think, oh, this is definitely a novel. It's more just feeling like consumingly interested in something.
Right, like you can't leave it alone.
Yeah, well, and it just feels so like this idea of, you know, what would Hillary's life have been like if she had fallen in love with Bill but not married him? It's like, it's almost like you could have an endless conversation about that. It's not like almost like, oh, there was an awkward moment between two people at a cocktail party. I'm all like for awkward moments between two people at a cocktail party, but it's like, that's a finite thing. Whereas it's like, oh my God, like if you think of the implications for Hillary in the United States, if she hadn't married Bill, like that's just like, it's endless.
Yeah. It's definitely not a novella. I mean,
I thought it was. I want to write like a 200-page novel, because I think if somebody says to me, there's a great new book and it's 600 pages. I mean, again, I will read a 600-page book, but I'll be like, maybe not immediately. And if someone said, this is an amazing book and it's 200 pages, like I probably will be like, I'm going to get my hands on that this afternoon and I will have read it in like 48 hours.
Yeah, I know. I mean, as you were saying that, I was thinking there's definitely a kind of shameful part of me that loves picking up a short book.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And it's, I mean, I love reading, but even so, like, maybe it's that, I'm not someone, I will not finish a book if I don't love it, but it's like, it's very effortless for me to finish like a 150 or 200 page book.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you a little bit about sex scenes. Always a fun topic. You really don't shy away from sex. And I think Rodham is, you know, one of the remarkable things about that book, I thought, was how you portrayed the sexual chemistry between Bill and Hillary, between fictional Bill and fictional Hillary. And you don't do that annoying thing that some writers do where they kind of fade to black just as the sex scene begins, end the chapter. And I think you write it very well. How important do you think it is to include sex in a novel? I mean, not just any novel, obviously, but
yeah. I mean, I don't think it's like a novel must include sex. Like, I think it depends on the, or it's not a novel, or no one should read it. It's more like I think the writer should do what the novel calls for. And the thing is, my novels are all like they're very, I mean, this is, sex aside, they're very specific, or they show people in a very intimate way. So it would, like, it would be very plausible that my novel would show a person like brushing their teeth or making a grocery list or just like, you know, sitting on the toilet, like the things that people do in the course of a day. And so if it's like there's a romantic relationship, it just seems the question to me is not why would you include sex, but like why wouldn't you? And then I understand that it's very different to read about someone like brushing their teeth versus somebody having sex, but it's kind of like, actually, believe it or not, comes from, I think, the same impulse. I mean, I think it comes from a few impulses in me, but one is like just giving a comprehensive sense of what it's like to be this person. And you know, some people, I think, like have maybe they're different in bed than they are out of bed. And like, are they more confident or are they less confident? Or, you know, can they feel really close to another person or are they distant? And I was having a conversation with someone about Rodham, and I said something where I was like, oh, I didn't know I thought that. But like I said, I think a lot of times to read about sex like makes people think of their own sexual experiences or maybe like lack thereof or sexual experiences they wish they'd have. So again, I think it's like that conversation between the reader and the writer. But I will say, like, I think that in writing sex scenes, I think I am opening myself up to mockery. And I think that, you know, like a person, you know, like obviously there are those, you know, awards given annually for like the yes. worst sex scenes, which I think is a really ungenerous, like shooting so fish mean. In a barrel. Yeah, I think it's really mean because it's kind of like it's almost like giving an award for like clumsiest person or like you know, messiest hair or something. Like it's sort of like the person, like I'm trying something. And I have, because, you know, this is not my first book, I think I've made the choice, like, I know that there are people who will think my sex scenes are inappropriate. They'll think they're like cringe inducing, but I think they serve a purpose. And I think they, you know, add something to the novel that can't be added in a different scene. Like it's not, it would either be there or not be there. It's not like you could substitute the sex with something else. And so like, I'm kind of like, okay, opening myself up to mockery, it is like the price I pay for writing the book the way I want to write it. But it's certainly, it's not like I don't do it. I mean, I think if you said, like, if you polled the reading population, I think the truth is probably like 75% of people, like if you said to them, you could read this novel and like, there'll be explicit sex or there won't be explicit sex, I think probably 75% of people would say like, put that explicit sex in there. So, even, I mean, the people who don't like it kind of complain more vocally than the people who are like, ooh, that was delicious. But it's not for sales. It's not because anyone else tells me to do it. It's not, it's just like, no. I feel that it belongs there in like, depicting the totality of a character's life.
Yeah, and I think that very much comes, that is the, you are achieving the desired effect there.
Because sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, you know, when I read about fictional Bill and fictional Hillary's sex life, I felt that it added a lot to a kind of reader's understanding of what the deal is there, you know, what the connection is between them and what is so appealing about the whole thing for Hillary. So yeah, I don't think it didn't read as gratuitous.
You might have to be careful, like I feel like that quote could end up on the front of the book.
Go for it, I would love that would make my life. What are the best or kind of most useful lessons that you've learned over the years that have improved your writing?
I think so many like things that help your writing or my writing have nothing, they have to do with like time management and organization, and it's not stuff about like crafting sentences, but like so is that the kind of answer, like do you want like the, okay, so a few things I would say, like one is if you're writing, like if you have some writing project, whether it's big or small, like one, maybe think through in your head ahead of time what you're going to be writing and how you're going to start. And so, like, what's the next scene, or what's the beginning, or what's the first few sentences? And so it's almost like the difference between like, let's say it's Wednesday night. I don't know. I feel like I eat really early, but like, let's say it's like six o'clock at night or 7 o'clock at night. That is not the time to be like, what should we make for dinner? The time to be like, what should we make for dinner is 4 days earlier. And then you like buy the groceries and you, so it's kind of like planning ahead mentally. And then also planning ahead, like, you know, clearing off the desk if you have a desk, or even if you don't have a desk, like thinking about physically where will you sit and write, and also scheduling it and treating it like it's an appointment with another person. Look at your calendar and decide ahead of time, you know, whether it's like maybe even like the next 2 weeks when your writing time will be, and, you know, like write it in your calendar, and then when it is your writing time, sit in your writing place and don't do anything else. Like, it's okay not to write, but don't do anything. Don't, like, don't get online, which is very hard, obviously. Don't you know, read a book, don't start cleaning, just sit there. And if you have, if because, you know, you're having this like sort of quiet mode, if you think like, oh my God, I should have answered like such and such email 3 weeks ago, which is the kind of thought I have, write it on a piece of paper next to you, but don't do it in that moment. So like, let's say you say to yourself, I want to write a novel and I have 2 hours a week. Like, I have an hour, you know, at 6 a.m. on Tuesday and 6 a.m. on Thursday. I'm going to get up in the morning and work on it. And then, and just like, it's almost like set yourself up to succeed in those moments by kind of planning ahead as much as, but like thinking what you're going to write about, like, you know, organizing yourself, maybe like clean the space where you're going to work, and then just kind of like accept that probably, like, it would be almost shocking if the writing you produce, especially at first, is as good as you planned for it to be. Just sort of,
yeah,
like know that you might be horrified by your own you know, work, and just like keep going and finish the thing that you're doing. And I think probably like the deeper in that you get, the more kind of like satisfying it will be. And also like think to yourself, like, if you say, I want to write a short story or I want to write a novel, do it to the end. And then, you know, if it's terrible or if you think it's good, but then it doesn't sell, like, I think you still can learn, which is, you know, maybe easy for me to say, but I think you still can like learn a lot, or it can be this experience of, you know, completing a big project. It's like a useful, satisfying exercise. Or maybe like you've taught yourself to write a novel, and then next time you can teach yourself to like write a good novel.
Yeah, that is such good advice. I'm going to take that myself, because, yeah, I mean, actually setting aside a time to do it, I think,
oh,
is,
yeah,
particularly good.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, this is the weird thing. I almost feel like, it would be interesting to test this, but I almost feel like if one person read a book about time management and one person read a book about like writing tips, and then they both tried to write a novel, I almost think the time management person would be like better off.
What do you feel proudest of when you look back at your writing life so far?
That's an interesting question. I mean, again, I feel very, this is almost the opposite of what you're asking, but I feel very conscious of how lucky I've been. And even like I wrote one book before I had kids, and that book did well enough, like it sold well enough, that it kind of put me on this path where I could sell another book, I could write another book, I could like, and it's, I mean, I actually like believe in my own abilities. And so it's not, I'm not saying I've only been lucky and like almost like books fell in my head. Like, it's like, I think I have some talent, which again, that's subjective, but I believe in my own talent. I work hard, and I also think I've been, you know, super lucky, like those things coexist. But, so I would say the thing I think that I feel proudest that, like, I think I have written books that I would like to read if I weren't me. And I think, yeah, I mean, I think in the end, like, I sort of stand, I mean, in all honesty, my second book, The Man of My Dreams, which some people, not by accident, some people don't know it exists, but I feel like I don't stand by that book in terms of, like, I think it's fine at the level of the sentence. I don't think it's well structured. Like, it's dinosaur bones are not in place. And I think I learned a really important lesson early on from that, which is, like, I can't control anything else about the process, except I can control whether I put a book that I stand by and feel proud of into the world. And so ever since then, like, I've had kind of fluctuating sales, fluctuating views. But I feel like all the books are books that I would like to read. And like, in the end, I mean, like, how else do you sort of assess quality or worthwhileness or like, you know, justification for how you spend your own time?
Yeah. Well, I will always buy anything that you publish. So you have a guaranteed customer here. I don't know if that helps. Tell your publisher.
One at a time. Every head counts. Yes, thank you. Thank you. No, these were such good questions. It was actually fun.
That was Curtis Sittenfeld, and her new novel, Rodham, is published in ebook and audiobook on Tuesday, the 19th of May. Or you can pre-order the hardback, which is out on the 9th of July. And I really highly recommend that you do. If you enjoyed the interview, please share it. That would be wonderful for me. Post it online or send it to somebody who might enjoy it. Thanks so much for listening, and see you next time.